8 years ago, when wildfires threatened musician David Berwald's family home in Los Angeles, he salvaged all but forgotten boxes belonging to his grandfather. Among the discoveries inside them were a spy camera, a samurai sword, breathtaking photographs, and diaries and letters that would change his life forever. The platinum-selling artist behind Welcome to the Boomtown and Come What May spent 7 years and sold his music catalog to write the novel The Fire Agent, based on his grandfather's astonishing story. The result is a gripping chronicle of the rise of fascism in both the West and Japan. The title of the book, The Fire Agent, it is published by Spiegel & Graw, and it's a great pleasure to welcome David Berwald to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've been listening to you for years.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Thank you very much. Give us a sense of how this particular novel came about of you taking on such a story and such a rich story.
The groundwork for the thing's been laid for my whole life, but the triggering incident was when I was closing up a family home about 8 years ago that was threatened by wildfires and the like. I discovered some boxes that had been packed up on my grandfather's death decades before, long before I was born. And in these papers, not only did I find clues to the mysteries of my own family, but also to the mysteries of how political power developed in the first half of the 20th century in ways that it completely changed my understanding of history.
When you, and this was some 8 years ago, as you mentioned, and so what was it when you found this and make these discoveries that you think to yourself, this is a story that you want to tell? This is something that you want to write about and ultimately to have be this major novel?
Well, I really had very little choice in the matter. You know, it was when you're presented with this kind of material, you have to, you know, I didn't know that I was going to write a novel or what I was going to do, but I just needed to find out what I was looking at and then find a way of kind of dealing with it emotionally as I was making these discoveries. And, you know, I've always used art for that and writing. So it sort of, they kind of joined forces together.
You were all in on this. I mean, you sold your music catalog to do this.
I sold everything. I moved out. I moved to a town where I knew no one, and it became just my sole guiding principle. It was just I had to know more about this.
And what does that allow you when you have a mission like that, and it is so I would assume burning in you that you are taking any scrap of information you can get.
Yeah, I had to do a lot of squirreling about. You know, one of the reasons I moved to the East Coast is because there were libraries here that had specialty materials that had not been digitized that I needed access to. And, you know, it became a long, deep dive into not only my own family, but the rise of fascism in both Germany, Italy, and Japan, and ultimately the United States.
Tell us about Ernst Berwald and how this story starts there.
Well, he was a very privileged lad, a German Jew in Frankfurt. His father was the headmaster of a very elite school that the Rothschild banking family had started there about 100 years prior. And, you know, it was a very specific, very great education that he received. And what I've learned about the school, that it was called the Philanthropine. And what they did was they would give people a really good, basic, fundamental education that was just, you know, very heavy on languages and geography and mathematics and the like. And then they would apprentice them at various places, either a bank or a chemical company or a diamond something, or, you know, around them somewhere mm-hmm. in the world and among all their holdings. And my grandfather was sort of selected to learn. He had great gifts with languages, and in a very musical ear. He was a terrific violinist. And so they sent him to Milan, where he learned Japanese and Japanese history and culture and some martial arts and the like. And then they sent him to Japan to sort of act as a economic, cultural, industrial ambassador. And he consorted with the imperial family, and he was just at the center of power at that intersection of Japanese and German power at that pivotal period in history. And as a German Jew, and as an Enlightenment Jew, as a Haskalah Jew, his first loyalty was always, to Tocqueville and democracy. And he was really in Japan. He entered Japan at a moment when the Kokutai, the far right, what we would call the Tories or royalists, were in a pitched battle for the soul of Japan with the Keitai, the modernists who did not believe in Japan's destiny of conquest. So it was an argument really between two Japanese factions, one determined to seize other territories by force, and the other determined to act to, to set up Japan as the gateway between the West and the East for trade. And that was the side he was on. Gradually, the Keitai were gradually eliminated in Japan, and these were his colleagues and protectors. And at some point, I believe it was 1933, he changed loyalties and became an American intelligence asset, which he remained in Tokyo for about 8 years before ending up in San Francisco, where he then was. He spent the war teaching at the intelligence school in San Francisco. So, fascinating character.
You mentioned the sword. You found a camera, and you find the paperwork, and then you start to put all of this together. And even when you mentioned the libraries, so I assume you come up with a list of the things that you need to research.
There was a lot, it was more than I could really handle it, and a lot of it, there's a lot of stuff in Middle German and in Japanese and things like that. There were a lot of translations involved. I'm not a historian, so I'm a songwriter. If I have any training in anything, it's which I don't, but it's poetry, which is not really the same kind of line of work as this. So I had to, find ways of using the skills that I'd acquired in my prior careers for this particular challenge.
And when you realize, and again, the things that you were researching, these were very specific questions, but also general history, I'm guessing, of the time and a context to put all of this information into.
Well, what I had was I had a guide in Ernst's movements. And I knew that in his movements lay the story of this thing that I was finding. So where he went, for example, he went to Shanghai in 1910. So I looked at what was going on where he went, and did a deep dive there. And this kind of tumbling approach, the first thing I did was I found a lot of the major events. But then I had to go through and do this sort of reconstruction of timelining and all that kind of stuff of the sequence of events. And it was challenging, but really fun. I really enjoy that part of it myself, actually.
When you think of that, that the of what the novel demanded from you, I mean, this was really something that you're coming to terms with all this. You have to process all of this. And I'm curious as to, I mean, you say that whenever Ernst's name came up, your father would change the subject. And so now those puzzle pieces start to come together.
I.G. Farben is a very questionable legacy to have. I.G. Farben became one of the most evil corporations in history. You know, they built Auschwitz and they made the Zyklon B gas in the death camps, and they supplied, you know, both the Kaiser and the Nazis with the gunpowder and gasoline that they needed to run their wars. You know, without Farben synthetic gasoline, the Germans would not have been able to last a year. And this is a major problem. Yeah, it was a controversial history that he carried.
He rose through the ranks at IG Farben. And what brought him there in the first place? Because he's also operating as a German spy.
Well, I mean, you know, for the beginning of it, the spying was certainly industrial spying. He was just keeping track of what the Japanese were doing and what they needed. The influence and espionage thing really started, I think, in the mid-20s, after World War I. Before that, I think he just did your basic industrial spying and just kind of just keeping tabs on industrial developments and in Asia and the like, and only really got into the political intrigue in, you know, after he got out of a prison camp during World War I.
David Berwald is our guest. The name of the new novel is The Fire Agent. He resigned from IG Farben in 1938. What led to that resignation and how did it change? Because he had a cover at that point.
Well, you know, IG Farben embraced full-scale Nazification in 1938, and the Nuremberg Laws were signed in 1938, and Farben had begun their relationship with the Nazis under a cloud of that they were too Jewish a company, and so they were sort of purging their own ranks. Ernst was one of the last to go just because the contacts he had in Japan were irreplaceable. You know, you could not just send somebody in and have those kinds of relationships. So he was necessary for them. You know, I think that not Karl Duisberg, but his boss at IG Farben, the chairman of the company, had arranged for membership in the Nazi Party for people that he found valuable. And I think that he arranged for my grandfather to be sort of an honorary member of the Nazis, which he, you know, I think that was the last straw for him. And he also was he was also dealing with a tremendous influx of refugees from Europe who were taking the Siberian route to Shanghai, and inevitably got stranded in Japan. Shanghai had no visa requirements. Japan had very strict ones, and so he often had, you know, 2,000 people under his care in those last 2 years in Japan. You know, it's not like a James Bond story. Although maybe it is, I don't know, but it's a story of, you know, elites moving money around and running espionage operations.
So two questions that came to my mind as I was reading the novel, and one is the decision to write it as a novel.
Well, I'm just not a novelist. You know, I mean, I'm not a historian. I'm an artist. And also, you know, I wanted to have like some sex in
Okay,
it.
so you wanted to have some fun in telling the story.
Yeah, I didn't want to do a, you know, I didn't want to drag everyone through our, you know, no, I wanted to make a fun adventure, some adventure story, rollicking thing, you know, jaunt through crazy history.
Do you get an understanding as to you find this trove of your grandfather's documents in this storage unit? And business records, intelligence records, lots of photos, letters, diaries. Just do you understand why they were kept? It would seem if there was shame attached that at some point they would have been destroyed.
Yeah, I think they were just forgotten, really. I mean, I think, you know, I think when he died, his study was packed up in boxes, and it just probably made its way from one storage unit to until it ended up in my father's, you know. It was a vague aura of that's not what we're going to be talking about, you know, which I interpreted as shame. I don't, you know, I may have misread it. I don't know.
The name of the novel is The Fire Agent. Give us a sense of that title and that position.
I saw the fire agent as him, but you know, a fire agent is gasoline is a fire agent, but also the stuff that's in fire extinguishers is a fire agent, and also the sweep of history that was pushing us into this, you know, into this new age of conflict and fascism, and which ultimately ends in fire. You know, you deliver these things and you're delivering fire. I mean, a big thing for me was tracing how idealism is corrupted, and how things can start out with the best intentions and end up with mass murder. And it's just been a fascinating thing. You know, the Japanese were incredibly humane to my grandfather in a military POW camp. And 17 years later, the Rape of Nanking happened, which is one of the most horrific examples of a nation going mad in history. And that's only 17 years. That fascinated me. You know, as a musician, you know, seeing beautiful things be corrupted is
Right.
part of my thing. So, you know, an innocence abused, hopes dashed, greed triumphing. Yeah.
It is so eventful, and the story that you tell, and there is this mix, of course, of the historical figures as well as characters that came from your imagination. In what is over two world wars, this is quite a time frame that you're dealing with as well.
I was perhaps ill-advised as a debut, but you know, it was a lot to take on. But you know, I honestly believed you know, I mean, people look at songs, you know, and they think, oh, well, a song is only 3 minutes long or whatever. It's only got 300 or 400 words in it. There's no preparation for writing a huge historical novel with this kind of research required. But you know, the truth is, 1,000 songs, which I've probably written at this point. That's training. And even beyond that, learning how to score films, which I did for many years, where you learn to, you know, you learn about pacing, drama, and also writing for single note instruments, monophonic instruments like the voice or flute or that kind of thing, where in writing music, you're creating these intersections of melodies, which create these moving harmonies, which go through the whole piece, which define the piece. And I just use those principles. I use the principles that I learned as a lyricist for characterization. And I learned the principles I'd learned as a composer for structuring scenes and the entire book itself, which is kind of, I mean, I was aiming for the Beethoven's ninth structure of the, you know, of the intro, but four acts and an outro. But I needed five, but I was trying. That was the idea anyway. It was all these things, you know, these things are hard to organize in your mind, and the best way to do it that I found is to think of it as music. You know, I don't know what else to say about that.
You, in your career, in your musical career, you've collaborated with Springsteen and Sheryl Crow and Joni Mitchell and Hans Zimmer, and this is obviously a very different work to become novelist as you earlier discussed. But you have described this as really a 600-page novel akin to writing a song a day.
Yeah, that's really how I looked at it. You know, I have no fear about writing songs. I can write songs. I could literally write you a ballad with a broken arm and somebody putting a gun in my ear. I'm impervious. So I knew that. And I said to myself, thinking that hopefully this is true, well, you can do that. That means you can write a page. If you can write a page, you can write 2 pages. If you can write 2 pages, you can write three. And at first, I really thought I was just kind of deluding myself. Like, so you're saying, oh, yeah, you can do this, sure. I tried to figure out a way to convince myself. But it actually was true, and ultimately, I came to feel that there's really no major difference between writing something like this and writing 600 songs, So it's just a way of doing it. It's just a way of dealing with the whole thing, really, I guess.
Given that you gave up so much to do the novel, are you continuing both pursuits?
Yeah, I mean, I play, I use music to live. Music is the lens through which I view just about everything, really. It's how I organize things in my mind. So that never goes away. But, there's a big difference between loving music and being a professional musician. And sometimes, too, my father always said, you love music, David. You should be a dentist, and he was sort of right, because you always end up, if you do something too long or too often or under too many hostile circumstances, it ceases to be as beautiful and pure as one would like it to be, especially something as beautiful and pure as music.
The name of the new novel is The Fire Agent. It is out from Spiegel and Gras. And David Berwald is the author. David, I thank you so much for sharing with us. It's a great pleasure to have you with us and to share this incredible story.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for having me, and thank you for all you do for literature.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.